On Pilot TV this week, we're checking back into The White Lotus as Mike White's comedy of ill manners returns to Sky and Now. Plus, we're stepping into the ring with an almost obscenely buff Stephen Graham in A Thousand Blows on Disney+. Plus, we are joined by a cavalcade of guests this week because Jesse Plemons stops by to talk Zero Day, and all three stars of Apple's Surface pop in to tell us about that. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to Pilot TV, your essential guide to every show that matters, and a podcast that has a slight conundrum this week. You see, there are a lot of shows out this week, and I mean a lot of shows. In fact, the schedule is absolutely stacked. However, the big shows aren't the only things in abundance this week, because the other thing in abundance is what, Kay? Extremely heavy embargoes. Mm. Because all of the big shows, it seems, this week, or almost all of them, are heavily embargoed, and we cannot talk about them. So Reacher Season 3, embargoed. Surface Season 2, embargoed. Zero Day, heavily embargoed. So while we do have a pair of pretty exciting shows to talk about on this week's show, there are a few glaring omissions, some of which we'll cover off in Pilot Plus. And, you know, when that cup overfloweth, maybe we'll pump one into next week as well. Who knows? We shall see. But helping me deal with this logistical nightmare are my two co-pilots, Boyd Hilton and Kay Ribeiro, neither of which are embargoed, to the best of my knowledge. Is that right?
Well, a lot of what I'm about to say may be embargoed.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You know how he likes to fly in the face of any kind of
rules
and convention?
He will not be constrained.
No.
He will break embargoes and he will spoil at his whim.
Going a bit far, okay, thanks. I'll talk about stuff that's embargoed.
Go on then, do it. I dare you.
I've just hot-footed it as we speak now today from interviewing Christina Hendricks of Mad Men fame and Chris O'Dowd, who together are in a new show, a new Sky show called Small Town Big Story, which Chris O'Dowd has written, produced, directed, and stars in.
Wow.
And it's heavily embargoed, the actual, obviously the show, and my opinions on the show. It's kind of inspired, though, by, you know how Game of Thrones famously, a lot of it was filmed in Ireland?
Yes, it was.
And so So Chris thought, well, what is that like for the people who live there? You know, in these, if you're living in a small village in Ireland and suddenly Game of Thrones, 20 million per episode Game of Thrones arrives on your doorstep, what are the ramifications? So that's the kind of crux of it. That's what it's about. It's about big Hollywood TV production coming to a tiny town in Ireland. I chatted to them both, but I had to watch. I did watch four of the six episodes last night. Thought I had to do my homework. I would have watched all six, but it was getting late, even by my standards. And
3 o'clock?
4, 5, 6.
1:30.
Oh,
that's early evening, isn't it, really?
Yeah. But yeah, it's very interesting. We'll be reviewing that in a couple of weeks' time.
There's quite a glut of these at the moment, because obviously we had the franchise. We've got the studio coming. We've got this as well. There's a lot of inside baseball TV production-y stuff going on.
Yeah, there is, yeah. But this is different enough, because that's the kind of inspiration and backdrop, if you like. But it's actually also a bit of relationship / revenge / whatever comedy drama, because Christina Hendricks' character is coming. She goes back to her, it's her hometown where she's going to make this show. She's the big Hollywood producer, and there's a whole backstory with her and the main character played by Paddy Considine.
So she does the accent?
Oh, no. She's a Hollywood producer coming back. She's moved 20 years ago. She was in the town.
Since then
she's been a big Hollywood producer. She doesn't do the accent. One might say, thankfully, only in the sense that it's a hard accent to get right.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to see this because I am going to Dublin to the premiere.
It's your jolly, it's for this, isn't
it's
it?
It's not a jolly,
I forgot
it's
about
a work
that.
Trip.
The massive jolly.
We've had to massively adjust our schedule so that Kay can go on a massive jolly to celebrate.
I am being a roving reporter, correct, for Pilot TV Pod.
Oh, yeah.
A guest of Sky to go to the premiere in Dublin. And I'm taking that one for the team, for you guys, basically.
And what coverage is the podcast getting from this essential work trip that you're going on?
What are we getting? No, I'm getting to go to the premiere and I will be talking about it extensively.
Oh, you'll be
when I get
networking.
Back.
I see what you're saying.
When we get that big Sky deal.
Yeah.
Right,
okay.
You're not going to regret it.
That seems fair.
Where is the premiere? In a small town in Ireland?
No, it's in Dublin.
In Dublin.
Yeah, so the small town is Dublin. Yes.
Well, you know, it could have been in a small town outside that could have found that, because the actual small town feature in the show is fictional, by by the way, BTW. That's very exciting for you.
Yeah.
Hear my live report next week. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. We don't usually do live premiere reports, do we? But maybe this is
no, maybe
thing.
We will.
If there are any like TV channels listening, you want to send me to a different country to cover a premiere, I'm more than happy to offer my services.
That is very magnanimous of you.
Thank you.
And an offer I'm sure will be taken up. No, I'm very pleased for you. And then, by the way, they're hour long episodes, so you know, like it's 45 minutes, 50 minute episodes, so it was quite a commitment to watch all of them.
Wait, are we meant to commend you now?
Yes.
For doing your job?
Do you have the silver star that Boyd requested for this?
Well, you know,
or did you leave behind?
I'm just saying, well, she's off on the jolly, I am doing the
I'm
groundwork.
Riding on your coattails, you do the hard work.
Boyd puts in the work, and Kay reaps the rewards. Yeah, that's how this works.
The face of Pilot.
hosting the thing tonight as well. Anyway, let's not rake over old coals. What I've been watching is Big Boys. I finished Big Boys.
Me too.
Yes. Have you just finished it this week?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Absolutely incredible.
Devastating.
The last two episodes, because mm-hmm. they're kind of like, they kind of deal with the same thing really, don't they? But from different standpoints, different points of view, in a way. And Jack Rook, the creator, returns on screen in the last episode. And I won't go into it in too much detail because the annoying thing, one of the things about the show, like others, is it's going out live each week, so to speak, in double bills, Sunday nights, Channel 4, but it's also all available already on channel4.com or wherever it is.
More OD4.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, the word is devastating for the last two episodes.
And also because it's over, that's what's devastating as well. I felt like it was a series of two halves. Like the first two episodes were so funny and light. And then he does what he does best, which is like completely sucker punch you with the emotion. And it is fantastic. I honestly was weeping. Because the thing is, if you've ever lost anyone as well, it brings up a lot of emotion. So yeah, I was just openly weeping, but also just delighted that, you know, that he made this amazing three-series show. And I'm so excited to see what he does next.
Yeah, and he said this in an interview actually recently. He said, you know, he's really looking forward to the challenge of writing a thing that's not massively autobiographical, like this so obviously is. This is autobiographical in like myriad ways, you know, in terms of stuff about his dad, his best friend. It's very, very reflective of his own experiences. So I'm sure whatever he does will be brilliant. But he's done such an incredible job of handling the serious elements of it with the comedy, and that he always has a funny line about to come, even in the worst, like most saddest moments. Having said that, sometimes when it's not appropriate, he won't force it. Like all of the great lines, all of the great situations come from the characters, etc. He's just done a brilliant job. But the other thing that I would say is there's a star cameo in the final episode, which is brilliant.
It is. Incredible. Do you know what? I interviewed Dylan and John for this, and in the series launch, Jack had...
Dylan Llewellyn and John Poynting.
Yes, sorry.
You're on first name terms.
Dylan Jono to you.
Yeah.
That was getting over familiar there. I can only apologise. during the launch, Jack Rook had said there's some great cameos, and we saw that Rylan was there in the first couple of episodes, and he said there's one more coming in the last episode, and he wouldn't reveal who it was. And anyone who's watched this, all three series, is just going to be completely... bowled over. It is brilliant. And during my interview with the guys, I was trying to guess. I was doing like a hot and cold game with them. I was completely, completely off the point. I didn't get it at all, but it was great. Just finally on that, because this is what I've watched as well. I know you said Yemi was the MVP, which he is great.
In the early episodes.
But I have to say, I think Katie Wicks and Jules is.
Oh, no.
She was astonishing.
Yeah, but she comes into her own in the last couple of episodes. That was based on the first half of the series, if you like. Yeah, but yeah, she's brilliant. And again, like surprising that she becomes more prominent in the last couple of episodes.
But actually the perfect decision, right?
Because
she's just been this 100%. Background character, sort of on the periphery. And I thought it was so fitting that she came to the fore.
Mm. And then one, and the other thing I was going to mention is there's a whole, Saturday Night Live is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And there's going to be like the fifth anniversary episode is, it's just chock-a-block with comedy and acting legends, etc. But there's a show on Sky Comedy on demand / now about where all of the kind of SNL cast members talk about their auditions and how they got the job and what they had to go through to do it. And it's brilliant. It's really, really funny and insightful. And just and they show they get the it's not a massively original idea, but they get these people, Amy Poehler, they force her to watch her audition tape and it is excruciating. She is she's like, I can only watch it for a minute. I can't watch it for a minute. And they force her to watch it. And it's so funny. And it's so interesting. It's the kind of thing they all have, because they're all absolute fans of the show, the more recent stars who started in SNL. And because you can almost sense the desperation in them to become a part of it, because the stuff they end up doing in their audition is extraordinary. So yeah, it's a really funny, interesting
channel?
Sky Comedy / now Sky on demand.
Go check it out.
It's been a week for audition tapes, hasn't it? Really. See the Bond audition tapes. Obviously, this is film-related news. Really, that came out early this week.
Oh,
did you
no,
not see
what?
Rupert Friend, Henry Cavill, Anthony Starr, Homelander?
What they've been leaked?
They all auditioned for Casino Royale way back when.
Oh right.
And the audition tapes, yes, leaked. And
that's interesting.
What's your appraisal of it?
Well,
I thought you were going to say they auditioned tapes for the new next Bond, but not for the film.
No, this was the one that Daniel Craig ultimately got.
Right, yeah.
But obviously, Henry Cavill's so young in it, but also very good. I have to say, his was top of the pile for me.
It's a yes from James.
Yeah, it was a yes. It's a yes from me.
Do you resent the fact that Henry Cavill didn't get it and Daniel Craig did?
No, I think Daniel Craig was great.
Because then you would never have got The Witcher, would you?
So many things wouldn't have happened. No. So yeah,
interesting. Yeah. Mm. Anyway, that is what I've been watching, by the way.
Okay.
So, Big Boys, obviously.
I really pulled the rug from under you there, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Look, he's so gleeful about it.
No,
his lips are saying sorry, but his eyes are saying, yeah, gotcha. So, the other thing that I've been watching is, and it's heavily embargoed, is Toxic Town on Netflix, which is the Jack Thorne drama based on the real-life poisonings in Corby. I cannot say if I enjoyed it, but...
Because it's embargoed, not because you're not sure.
But I was moved.
Right.
That's what I was
saying. I mean, that might even be, that's testing the embargo then.
I don't know if it is, because it's based on poisonings. I mean, who wouldn't be moved? You'd have to be a robot.
Having said that, when you wrote about it, it didn't stop you from passing judgment either, which I had to do a quick rewrite on, but that's fine.
Was that a preview, not a review?
As you just pointed out, quite rightly, it's heavily embargoed.
Perhaps Kay was thrown by the star rating.
Well...
Let's not get into that. Okay, so that's what I've been watching. James, what about you?
What have I been watching? Well, we all three of us watched Yellow Jackets for Pilot Plus, which went out last week. And if you want to know what we thought about that, then you can listen to that.
Subscribe.
Then subscribe to Pilot Plus. That's right.
No spoilers. We're not going to spoil what we thought were.
No.
You have to force you to pay the, was it $3.50 or what?
Okay. Yeah, $3.49, Boydie.
Wow.
I'll be really interested to see if there's an uplift.
To find out what we thought of Yellow Jacket Season 3. It could happen. The other thing I saw was Unforgotten, which I did finish, and I liked an awful lot. And I do think the ending of this had a particularly potent punch. I actually really liked the resolution of this one.
Were you shocked and stunned?
I was shocked and stunned and moved, obviously, as well. But I do, in retrospect now, looking back on the six episodes, think that the culture war stuff was maybe a little heavy-handed. I think a little bit. It's odd, but looking back on it, I don't know. I don't know if I thought that was 100% necessary at times, but... There you go. But that's not to say I didn't like it. I do love Unforgotten and enjoyed it a great deal.
Well, I haven't seen the ending yet, but I think so far from what I've seen, I like the fact that it addresses current things going on in the world. And I think I'd much rather it did do that, even if it was slightly, in quotes, heavy-handed.
Because it feels like it attacks the culture war on every conceivable front.
Yeah, right.
It seems fair.
Yeah. It felt like, okay, we're really going for this.
Yeah, but I think that's fine. Yeah. Maybe this weekend I'll finish it.
Yeah. That's another show that's
airing live on ITV Sunday, Monday, but it's also all there already on ITVX. So I want, it's cannibalised itself. It is interesting, that whole...
They have to just cater to everyone's needs.
Yeah. But are you a binger, or do you not want
to? With the whodunit, if it was particularly, I was about to say egregious, let's go too far. If it was particularly a decision, Unforgotten, right, is an absolute classic whodunit. It's the whole raison d'etre of the thing. And to have it all out there in one go, because equivalent whodunits, they didn't do that with, ITV and BBC have both certain shows that are that reliant on not spoiling the plot and building up to the finale where the wherever the killer is revealed. But with Unforgotten they have, and I wonder whether they should have just kept it as Weekly.
So, like the White Lotus model.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there has been examples of BBC show, Line of Duty. I mean, going back quite a long way, but I remember vividly that they were like, "No, we, you know, while everything else is being box setted and all, everyone go Line of Duty, we're not going to do that because of the we love the weekly build up of excitement." I think with Unforgotten, they could have had a weekly build up of excitement where everyone's talking about it, and I think that's dissipated slightly when you make it all available in one go. Anyway, it's not no big deal,
and also because then you get the bingers who ruin stuff for people.
Like James.
She stares at James.
I feel attacked. Yeah.
What's funny is that we cut out the bit that was a spoiler. So now people just think I'm attacking
now
you.
Now I can't remember what we've cut out, what we've kept in.
That's it. So many cuts. Yeah. Can't even keep track of it. Speaking of things I've binged, I also watched the whole of Reacher, which is heavily embargoed.
Oh, yeah. Now, there's a thing. So you want we want us all to watch it.
I mean, I wanted you all to watch it.
I would anyway, because I'm a Reacher fan. But for a very specific reason, right?
Yes.
Let me ask you this without spoiling anything. So there's a thing in it that in the first episode or just generally or that we're looking
at? That's a good question. I think the first episode would cover it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. But
the more you watch, the better, I think.
Right. I'm excited to know what you're talking about.
We will have to discuss this, unfortunately, on Pilot Plus because it is heavily embargoed. This is not us just withholding it. Yeah. We literally can't talk about it now. And the only other thing I've been watching is From. Now, I alluded to this on last week's Pilot Plus, but From is a show, so the third season of this, I began it and I stopped and I finally got back into it. I got to about episode 3 and I kind of tapped out and I was like, do you know what? Mm. I'm done. I'm so bored of there's a pregnancy storyline and I'm so bored of there's another character who's titting about somewhere else. And I just thought, you know what? I'm done. I'm finished with it. And wow. I had 100% committed, because I'm slightly, you know, obsessive with these things. I couldn't stop in the middle of an episode. I had to finish the episode before tapping out. And it ended. And I was like, oh, you bastard. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. And they got a little, and so now I'm on like episode 6. I've just finished. So I'm near the end now. So I might as well just sprint to the finish line. But they managed to pull me back from the brink and they got me back.
You've done a full Don Corleone
cappuccino. Yeah. I've gone full international Immobiliari. So deep cut Godfather 3 reference. So I'm back on the From wagon.
Oh, okay. Well, one day I'll go back to it.
I will not. I will
Excellent.
Not go to it for the first time.
Okay, fine. Well, that is what we've been watching. Should we have this week's first guest?
Let's
indeed. So this week's first guest, or guests, I should say, are the triumvirate behind, or at the heart, I should say, of Apple TV's service. If you remember, so this is not the 2005 series about aliens in the sea, but rather a psychological thriller in which Gugu Mbatha-Raw play Sophie. And in season one, she has amnesia after what was assumed to be a suicide attempt. And she's back for even more twisty, turny surprises in season two. And we sent Jordan King along to talk to Gugu, as well as co-stars Oliver Jackson-Cohen and Millie Brady.
It is my absolute pleasure to welcome to the Pilot TV podcast the stars of Apple TV's Surface. That is Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Oliver Jackson-Cohen, and Millie Brady. How are we all?
Very good. Thank you. How are you?
So, I'm not too bad, thank you. It's been a long time coming, Series 2, and I can safely say it's been well worth the wait. I've had my screeners for about a week now, and I tried to like pass them out and do it bit by bit. I ended up sort of racing through in about 2 nights, and my head's still racing now. But how are you guys feeling now that you're finally getting to share this with the world? Excited? Nervous? Bit of both?
It's so exciting. Yeah, we've all worked so hard on the show. And I think it's really a departure from season one. You know, it's bigger, it's bolder, it's more fast paced. And I think we have a bigger cast and the story is deeper and, you know, more complex than before. It's really a privilege of a moment to be able to be sharing it with the world. I can't wait for people to see it.
Also, I mean, it took us because we started, when was it? Like May 23, and then we shot for a bit and then stopped because of the strike and then picked it up the following January. So it's been quite a long kind of process that we've been sort of waiting to kind of get this out. So it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. And then for yourself, Millie, how are you feeling about it all? Because you get to step into the spotlight a bit more this time around.
Yes, exactly. For season one, I was
out in Vancouver for 5 months, but with only a couple of days of filming. And so I became like a super fan of the show where I just turn up onto set every day and watch what they were doing. And then, so now in season two, to be just going into the Huntley madness has been so much fun, and getting to properly get stuck in, and also working with such a cool group of people. And all of the new people that have come in have just added to an already awesome crew. So it's been incredibly fun and just really exciting for us to finally share it.
Well, like I say, it's definitely been well worth the wait. And we've sort of touched on there already. You were out in Vancouver when you were shooting series one, also out in San Francisco. And this time we're heading into new territory with series two. We've got new power dynamics at play. We're starting to understand these characters in a different way, but also we are literally in new territory. So you've come over from San Francisco and Vancouver to London. I was just wondering, for you guys getting to sort of play on home turf a little bit, how's that been for you? And also, do you think that the vibe shifts at all moving back across the pond?
Yeah,
I think so.
Definitely.
Go on.
No, I was just going to say, London feels like its own character in the show. It's the places as well that we filmed are places that a lot of us have like grown up with, and suddenly seeing it with the Apple effect and the Hello Sunshine effect, where everything suddenly is taking on this really beautiful, cool new personality, where I think the pace of the show has changed, and this season we get like catapulted into this really fast-paced world. And I think having the total shift in scenery alongside that shift in pace and that shift in new characters coming in, it keeps an audience guessing like every step of the way. And this season, as you know, is like totally fast paced and just mad.
Yeah. And it's really fun, I think, on a story level, but on a personal level as actors, I think for all of us, it's so meaningful. For me especially, you know, I haven't worked in London for a while. I shot Loki in London, but that was all at a studio, you know, so to have season two here with these fantastic, iconic locations, like, you know, the Tower Bridge or the British Museum these incredible, you know, even this country house that is, you know, the Huntley's estate. It's really special. And it's really cool to be able to work with a British crew. We've had an incredibly diverse and talented crew on this set that's really, you know, has worked on some amazing productions. And the crews and the talent, the production design, the cinematographers, the British directors, you know, it just changes the feel and the energy and keeps it alive.
You touched on there the idea, like, it's a lot more fast paced this time around. It was almost the first series, I think, that San Francisco setting for the most part gives you that kind of Hitchcock vertigo kind of psychological labyrinth, whereas this time it's like racing through the labyrinth of London instead. But something else that's changed in a big way this time around is the understanding of the characters that we as viewers are getting to bring into it, and also you guys as actors. It would be safe to say that the Sophie, the James, and the Eliza that we meet here are probably very different from who we thought we'd met in episode one, episode two of the first series. And I was wondering, when you guys actually got involved with this, I know you're an EP yourself on this, Gugu, but how much did you know about these characters and their relationships and where things were going coming into it? Because they changed for us as viewers episode by episode.
I mean, I feel like Veronica West, our showrunner, she is a genius and an encyclopedia of... I remember, I mean, we spoke about this. Millie said that you know, in our fittings for season one, like before filming had started, she already knew exactly all of the big plot points of season two. Yeah. She told, so we were made aware quite early on of where this story goes. And the whole thing, that's why I think, you know, the sort of shift tonally between season one and season two, it feels like this sort of, you know, unrelenting kind of propulsive thriller. And the pace of it feels completely different. And, I think all of it, that's all intentional. That was all exactly what Veronica West kind of had already kind of planned out in her head. So it, for us as, sort of actors, we were sort of given, you know, ideas of where the thing goes. But then I think there's a very different thing actually reading it and getting it in and going, oh my God, wow, okay. Mm. And the sort of nuance. And she does this incredible thing of, with all the characters, that they all kind of exist in this gray area where no one's good or bad. They're completely flawed. And sort of, and so it's up to an audience, or it's up to other people, and it keeps on changing. You keep on kind of flipping things on its head and not knowing who to trust, and then thinking you can trust this person, and then you can't. So it's quite stressful.
And then for yourselves, Gugu and Millie, how's that sort of arc of, I mean, obviously for yourself, Millie, like series one, you're this kind of ethereal presence that it's like, who is this mystery woman? And then series two, it's almost like you needed that season one to be less of you so that you could psychologically be ready to take on season two.
Totally. I think that the Veronica West, our showrunner, what kind of going off what Ollie had said, where for season one, I was in just a couple of scenes, but I remember Veronica coming into my trailer really early on and mapping out the history of my family, the Huntley family, and then also mapping out where she's at in present day and then where she goes in the future, which was like the most tantalizing thing ever as an actor. And that thing of being like, oh my God, I really hope that we're getting another season of this, because I knew the journey that she had to go on. And the snippets that we had of her were so mysterious in the first season. And I loved that it didn't give anything away. It just put in just a sprinkling of like, there's more to come of this character. And then for the second season, you're then as an actor with having this encyclopedia of knowledge for where the character's going, to then actually have to forget some of that, because as the episodes go on, there's so many twists and turns that for the character, Eliza doesn't really know whether to trust Sophie. She doesn't know who to trust. She kind of can't even trust her own family. And so then you're having to be like, right, I have this information, but now I need to pair all of that back and go on the journey of the character, which is something of like, I mean, a pretty horrible position to be in, where you don't know who to trust or where to turn. So that was just like, I think such a gift to have so much history to build upon is like incredible and really rare, I think.
And you had to be incredibly patient as well. I mean, that was the patience of Millie Brady with the journey of Eliza, you know, for season one, and the trust that it's going to pay off, you know. And I think that's testament to Veronica and her collaboration in keeping us all invested in our own characters, being collaborative to share. And obviously, as a EP, I was privy to the outlines of the story and conversations with Veronica about where the show as a whole was going. But I think, you know, it's really, you know, as I say, testament to her that she kept us all invested in our own character arcs. And I think, you know, this season it gets more complex, and certainly, you know, for Sophie and James, you already have this backstory. You have the shared experience. We as actors have the experience of being in Vancouver for all that time, you know, so there's less, you know, it's just, it already exists. You know, you already have that backstory in your muscle memory and in your bones. So it's really, kind of nice then that we get to kind of go to these more antagonistic places, or this more sort of cat and mouse kind of like, you know, revenge game that they're on together. And you can go there more boldly because you've got the other season supporting you.
Yeah, I'm imagining the press tour this time around has been a bit nicer for you as well, Oliver, because last time I watched back some of the interviews and there's this kind of underlying, look, he's playing a creep again. And then now we've got a much more complex understanding of James. And I think it's fascinating to see how you guys are able to then play that new dynamic. So I was wondering for yourself, there's this sort of thread running through surface. I'll open it up to you guys as well, because I think it's an interesting point. But the show has this tension between who we really are and then the roles that we're playing dependent on the situation in front of us. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you guys had this encyclopedia from Veronica, which sounds like something that I would really like to see. But also, when you're playing these parts that we're changing as viewers, our perception, but you're changing scene to scene how you're playing, Do you have like an anchor that you've developed? So you're like, this is who Sophie is, this is who James is, this is who Eliza is. Like, do you listen to any music? Did you have something in the script that you were like, this is my North Star? I was just wondering, like, where do you find that truth of this is who I am and I'll carry that now through however many series we get of this?
I mean, I have a scent for Sophie, like a scent that really, you know, gets me back into the character. I put it on today because I was it's like sense memory. It just kind of like brings you in a very sensory way into those memories. And I think because initially and certainly the story was about memory, you know, for Sophie finding her memory and losing her memory and these fragments. And I think that scent is really powerful to take you to a place of memory. So that for me is a real anchor, because as a character, Sophie is constantly, especially in season two, shifting her identity. She's changing looks. She's trying to fit in with this aristocratic world, you know, and so it is a sort of, it's almost like she's undercover in this high society, and she's constantly, you know, trying to see, to be who she thinks people want her to be able to give them the information she needs from them. So that's really helpful for me, and music as well, is really, really key. And then just being present with your co-stars. It's just such a phenomenal cast. I mean, you know, to be able to be in the moment with each other, and in the scenes that we have.
James, sugar babes. That's how he gets into.
So are you into? Have you guys got a scent that you go to for your characters? Are you listening to something, popping the earphones in before a scene?
My scent is a bakery.
I don't have scent. That's actually such a. I've never thought that must be quite an amazing way of getting sort of into a character. Eliza's quite chaotic, so I didn't have to do a huge amount to get into the character.
Method.
I quite liked that with Eliza. She's totally like, as soon as I thought that I had some kind of a grasp on like her, it should go off in a different direction, which I think again is really, really clever writing, where like no person is a two-dimensional one thing. And so I quite loved, because I find that even with myself, like I sometimes do stuff and I'm like, that's bizarre. I think that that's reality. Like I haven't worked myself out, so I definitely couldn't work Eliza out, but in a way just following her on this like quite chaotic mission of self-discovery and wanting to and constantly being pulled between right and wrong, that I think there's a freedom in thinking like I'm just trusting in the scripts and then the character that comes when it's good writing as well, which this is, like it sort of does so much of the work for you with that stuff, because you can just, you just trust in that. So yeah.
It's a fascinating journey. And I've got to let you guys go in just a second. Finally, just one last thing. It's very intense. This series gets even heavier as it goes on. What are you guys doing at the end of the day to just unwind and get out of those quite intense headspaces? Are you watching anything on Apple TV? Are you heading down to the karaoke bar singing some sugar babes?
I have to say, I'm just like Sophie. Yeah. I run a bath exactly like Sophie. I run a bath. I think, you know, when you're filming a really intense story with so many plot twists and turns, there's only so much story I can have in my brain. So I can't watch other shows while I'm making a show. I have to save them for afterwards. I love like a little bit of a nature documentary or something where I don't have to think about the acting and I don't have to think about watching performance or listening to a script or, you know.
Producer brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what I do, probably, if I'm being honest, get into a scroll hole.
Scroll hole.
I've never heard it called a scroll hole before, but I will use that now.
Stare into the abyss / I like a bath as well.
I do like, I just sing the entire Sugar Babes back catalogue. And then by that point, it's time to go back to work. So
So, and then put the shoulder shuffle from series one back in there as well.
Oh my God.
I've got your number here.
You actually missed out. There was in season one, and thank God it got cut out, there was a scene of me the guitar, which I still sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and have a about, where I had to sing Creep. And thank God they took it out, because that was, but that footage is somewhere.
It's somewhere
in the world.
On that tantalizing note, I will say # release the creep cut of season one. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you guys. Season two is brilliant. And I hope, amongst hope, that we get a season three as well.
That was the cast of Surface. Now time for this week's listener question. Kate, what do you have for us this week?
This comes from Severe Chicken.
Of course it does.
Who says, in honour of it being dark and cold and miserable, what are the best TV snowy scenes / settings? Fargo? True Detective? Night Country? Any snowy comedies?
Wow.
Has been sent to you both in advance.
Has it?
Yes. While you furiously Google, I will tell you my answer, my one answer.
All right, go on.
Which was Fortitude. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Beautifully shot.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
It was a British psychological thriller created by Simon Donald, I believe, and it was set in the fictional Arctic Norwegian settlement called Fortitude.
I do remember that, but I never saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, never
Tucci
saw that.
Tucci was in it, wasn't he?
He was in it.
Yeah, I did see it. It was good. Yeah, I really liked Fortitude,
That's on the sofa list, if you can believe that.
Yeah, well, I bet. Of course it is. Languishing.
I mean, the answer was mentioned in the listeners.
True Detective.
True Detective, Night Country.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, I'd have thought you'd have gone Murder at the End of the World.
Good point.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Good point. But I think, joint equal, obviously. both of them used their, you know, very snowy, chilly, cold settings to maximum effect. And in both of them, like, you know, the whole premise of True Detective Night Country is the icicle of dead people. So like you couldn't get much more reliant, the storyline totally reliant on the freezing locale that it's set in. And similarly, A Murder at the End of the World was all to do with, you know, the tracks in the snow and the all of that. So yeah, I mean,
Snow Hotel,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, those are perfect examples, aren't they?
No one's gonna stump for Yellow Jackets, I'm assuming.
No.
What do you think?
Absolutely.
Tune
not.
Into Pilot Plus. Yeah, that's right.
Spoiler alert.
Northern Exposure?
Oh yeah. Mm. Very good.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Fleischman was in trouble in that.
He was. Very much, yeah.
That was a good joke.
Yeah.
Unappreciated.
Well,
do you know what my answer would be? Game of Thrones. It would just be Game of Thrones. Everything beyond
winter
the wall
is indeed
winter
coming.
Is coming. That's
winter
right.
was always fucking coming, wasn't
yeah,
it? I mean,
kind of.
It was
yeah.
never not coming.
I mean, they have winter lasts for years,
yeah.
So that's the nature of Westeros.
And of course, I tell you, the most recent example was last week's episode of Severance. Fully in the snow.
There was snow, but then there's always snow in Severance because it's snow. It's always snowy outside.
Oh yeah, you're right. It is, isn't it? Yeah. God, just to add to the chilliness. Yeah.
Yes.
The ice white corridors and the snow outside.
That's right. Yeah.
But there was definitely more snow.
There was more snow. It was a particularly snowy episode
In the adventure last week. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So I have found myself now being very, like, on like snow patrol, if you'll pardon the pun, where I'm always trying to work out. Is it snow or is it paper? Like when you're watching a TV show, is it snow or is it paper?
Yeah.
Because when they do snow in movies and TV shows, they have these big blowers, don't they? And it's bits of shredded paper and they blow all over the trees and all over the floor. It's really thick shredded paper they put everywhere. And it's really realistic looking. But I've got to the point now where I'm always like, is that? And then sometimes you're like, no, it's definitely paper. Then you're like, well, actually, they've done like a whole football field's worth of the trees and everything goes on for miles. Like, how much paper must they have used to do this?
Good question. Yeah.
Boy, less interested in this than
No. I know what you mean. I always wonder whether it's real snow, yeah. I mean, it definitely was real snow in a Murder at the End of the World.
Because it was obviously shot there. But a lot of times when it's done on a soundstage or even when they're outside. So I was watching an episode of From and it's winter in From at the moment. And there was a bit where it was snowy there and I'm like, I don't buy that's real snow. I'm sorry, I just don't.
There's a
said
show
in quite a disconcerting way.
Sorry,
anyone who's watching on the camera.
Yeah, creepy Krampus voice. I find that fascinating. Like, at what point is it like logistically viable to find somewhere cold, or just to find a forest and cover it in paper?
We need an expert to get in touch.
Who cleans up the paper?
Like, we need someone to tell us the answers.
Right, like who goes around afterwards and like, because is it water soluble? Does it dissolve? Like, how do they get rid of it?
I wonder what the title of the person who cleans up all the snow, the fake snow, is. What is their job title?
The papier-mâché.
You know, yeah.
Santa.
Key paper grip.
Sorry. We need to have an expert answering it and do this as a franchise, basically stealing it for the rest of entertainment. We need someone, a snow expert, on set.
To call in and tell us the ins and outs of movie/TV snow. If you are the papier-mâché at any particular production, please do get in touch and tell us about that. I would like to know if you are working Snow Patrol. We need to hear from you. So.
We might have a listener whose job.
I dare say we do.
Yeah.
I want to know.
Stuntmen.
I want the logistics, how it's done, when they decide to do it, who cleans it up, all of that. Okay, that's the question. If you would like your question read out on the podcast, you send them in to us at Pilot TV Pod on Instagram, on Twitter, on what's it called? Blue Sky, and also on the subreddit. I think that broadly speaking covers most forms of communication. Shall we move on to this week's news?
I've got news headline of the week. From Variety, but it's got a slight. I mean, the weather spoiler chat is so excruciating, isn't it? But this is a headline in Variety for anyone can read right now, so blame them, right? And it's also connected.
Boyd basically saying, "Don't come at me."
Okay. Don't come at me. This is them. It's there. The quote is: "This is the story in Variety today." Arnold Schwarzenegger is not surprised by Sun Patrick's White Lotus nude scene. Quote, apple doesn't fall far from the tree, he says.
That's a great headline.
Which is brilliant. And then you get, so they're basically at the LA premiere of The White Lotus, which we'll be reviewing imminently on this very podcast. But this is the story. It's really funny. Arnold Schwarzenegger was completely unfazed watching his son Patrick's nude scene at the Monday night premiere of The White Lotus, season 3. Quote, I was so pumped to take a break from filming to celebrate at the White Lotus season 3 premiere, the Predator star wrote on Instagram on Tuesday. What a show. I could claim to be surprised to find out he has nude scenes, but what can I say? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Don't miss it on Monday, trust me. And the whole thing, from Arnie's point of view, is about his son being nude. That seems to be the main...
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, he's proud.
Respect for starting that in a semi-Arnold voice.
I know.
And then abandoning it very quickly.
That kind of bullshit to you.
You rightfully thought better of it.
Yeah, that was wise. If I had that level of self-restraint, our listeners would be much happier.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
How do you feel about that story, bearing in mind that you're a massive Arnie fan?
To be fair, I saw that. He posted it on his Instagram. It was him and Patrick Schwarzenegger, who is, of course, in The White Lotus, who we'll be reviewing later, and who does have his cock and balls on full display in the first episode.
James, please.
And so apparently Arnold was unsurprised to see this.
Yeah.
Presumably he knew that he had them.
Yeah, I imagine they had discussed
it. He knew that he had cock and balls.
Yeah, that's why I'm literally, yeah.
Well, that too.
It's
not like a spoiler for him.
Yeah. Patrick Schwarzenegger, it has to be said, has been, shall we say, typecast, I believe, in his career. He specializes in like sort of major league douchebags. That's his.
Yeah. Yeah. He's very good at it, though.
Yeah. He does do it very, very well. Yeah. And no spoilers for the review, but he does it well here as well.
Mm, exactly. We'll move on to The White Lotus later, obviously. That's just a little amuse-bouche. For White Lotus fans. This is interesting. Amy Adams has joined Javier Bardem in the Cape Fear series at Apple TV Plus. Any regular listeners will know, who pay any attention to what we say, will know that I am fascinated by the whole Cape Fear TV show idea. It's got a 10-episode order, which is quite long. Even for Apple TV, often they have 6 or 8 episodes. It's only 10 episodes. The series is based on both the John D. MacDonald novel, The Executioners, which inspired the 1962 original film Cape Fear, as well as the 1991 remake, directed by Martin Scorsese, obviously. The official logline for the series states, quote, a storm is coming for happily married attorneys Anna, played by Adams, and Max, played by Javier Bardem, a notorious killer from their past, gets out of prison, which is basically the premise of both films anyway. So how they stretched that into 10 hours, I will be absolutely fascinated to learn.
Makes you a little bit tired even thinking about it, doesn't it?
It does, correct. Now, I love Cape Fear. Yeah. I particularly love the Martin Scorsese Cape Fear, because it's like him showing off every technique he has in the book, and it's brilliant. And Nick Nolte is fantastic in it, and Juliette Lewis is amazing in it, and etc. Everyone in it is brilliant. But I'm absolutely intrigued by this as much as almost any other project going out there at the moment.
It was done very well with Presumed Innocent. Worked very well, sort of drawn out. But then they reformatted it. I think it was eight.
Yeah.
But it was, if memory serves anyway.
Yes,
but it was reformatted and worked very well. So I'm assuming they're going to be doing something similar here.
Yeah.
You're right, on the face of it, the story feels like it would run out of steam.
Yeah.
But Cape Fear is all about that sort of gradually growing sort of menace, dread and tension. Mm. And you've got to think that would... it must be very hard to maintain that over that amount of time.
Right.
That's a difficult thing too. Whereas Presumed Innocent has a different vibe to it. But look, you know, maybe they'll manage it. Maybe we'll eat our words and it'll be our show of the year. Who knows?
Oh, I'm always open-minded, always keep an open mind. But I'm just fascinated by how they do, essentially, because it's a story that revolves around one, two, three, four characters, really. The dad, wife, daughter, and the killer.
Mm.
So they're going to have to bring in a whole load of extra characters, I think, to fill it out. But we'll see.
In other news this week, here's the thing that's happened. So Peter Dinklage has joined Dexter Resurrection.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, yeah.
That's good. Always nice to see Peter Dinklage doing things. I'm still a little unsure on Dexter Resurrection, given that Dexter obviously died at the end of Dexter New Blood. But hey, that's why it's called Dexter Resurrection. So we shall see. He clearly survived. The other thing I was going to mention is, have either of you, and I already know the answer to this, so I don't know why I bother to pose these questions, have either of you ever played Magic the Gathering?
Absolutely
Kay
not.
Kay plays it, I know, on a daily basis when she finds time.
Yeah. Like a green rush deck, don't you?
Oh, mate, so into it.
So Magic the Gathering is a, dare I say it, quite nerdy collectible card strategy game, which originally, I believe it came about because people wait around at a lot of these big games tournaments. They wanted something that they could play on the move in between other games, and that's where it came about.
Like it's going
for years. But it's quite a cool game. But they have announced that there is a movie and TV universe in development for Magic the Gathering. Obviously, it's a card game, but it has a kind of a narrative to it where you get these sort of plane-hopping, dimension-hopping, powerful beings who summon monsters and things. Like, it's kind of interesting.
On cards?
Yeah, so it's a collectible card game, but there is a narrative to it. No, they're not. It's literally just cards. But you have like a... It's not like Top Trumps. Like, it's more involved than that.
Collectible card game, CCG, is that a thing or something?
Yeah.
Oh,
is it? Yeah,
I didn't know that. I generally have never heard of that before.
Yeah,
wow.
It is a thing. You can get many different ones. You get wrestling ones. There are all sorts of different card games.
Do you have them?
I do actually have some of these cards. To be fair, I've never played a game of it.
Just have them as mementos.
I got sent a load of the cards at work. Like, I got sent a load of them. So I have a
I thought it was a weird thing where you bought them and
they're on display.
But I've played the game on a games console. So I've played the video game version.
Oh, there's a video game as well.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But
I didn't know that. I thought it was analog.
It's based on the cards. And the video game is a card game. Like, you have cards on the screen.
What? So you're watching people play cards?
Well, you're playing cards yourself on screen.
Okay.
Yes.
Exciting.
Okay. Anyway, so there's going to be a lot of stuff coming for Magic the Gathering. So if you're a big fan of Planeswalkers, then, you know.
Cannot wait.
Can't wait.
I found this interesting. Ratings news.
Mm.
Super Bowl. It was the Super Bowl last weekend, as we recorded.
It was.
It got 127.7 million viewers, which makes it the most watched ever, which is extraordinary. Bear in mind, in this day and age, you know.
Is this because Taylor Swift was there?
Well, funny enough, I was going to say, partly, yes, it is. Because you've got now, with the Super Bowl, the game itself, which is exciting because it was, you know, can the team that's won it twice in a row win it a third time in the end? Absolutely, no, they couldn't. You've got Travis Kelce, and you've got her. Donald Trump attended it as well. I think the first sitting president to ever attend a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So people wanted to watch. Is he going to be booed? Is she going to be booed? Is, you know,
she got booed.
She got She didn't get booed because of who she is. She got booed by the opposition
fans
of the other team.
Because she's tied to the Kansas City Chiefs. Exactly. Then it was a Philadelphia crowd. Yes.
It's not a personal attack on her.
No.
Whereas what I've seen reports say, and I watched it on the night. Obviously, stayed up till 2:30 in the morning. Sunday night was that there was audible booing of Donald Trump when he arrived and they showed him on the big screen, and that they covered it up on the audio. People claim that on the official American broadcast, they kind of covered up the booing, which I find
extraordinary. That wouldn't surprise me. It's a bad look. Come on.
Yeah, but come on, it's your job as a channel, as a broadcaster to not to show what's going on. If he's getting booed, then he's getting booed.
I don't know what the ramifications might be for them.
This very much feeds into the current climate, isn't it? And the weaponization of truth, which is obviously, and just to tie this back to TV, this is, of course, what Zero Day is all about, isn't it? Which we'll be talking about on Pilot Plus, but because it's embargoed. But yeah, it is very much about that idea that truth now is whatever you make of it. Alternative facts are a thing.
Yeah, completely.
But yes, no, it would not surprise me at all if that had happened, especially because he made a meal out of Taylor Swift being booed. Because of course he did.
Yeah, I mean, he just out and out lied about that. Anyway, the other interesting thing, though, for me is that the Kendrick Lamar did the halftime show, and that also got record viewing figures of 133 million watching his show. And he got very mixed reviews, Kendrick Lamar, for it. I thought he was really good, but he had like Samuel L. Jackson took part in it and this, that, and the other. I think if you don't like, I mean, I'm not a huge rap fan, you'd be surprised to know. I know James is.
We don't like to make assumptions here.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
You could be.
But I think non-rap fans didn't criticised it for various reasons. But I thought he just as a performance and that, you know, with lots of guest stars, etc., I thought it worked pretty well. But it is amazing that in this day and age that ratings for something like that are going up and up and that it got record ratings. I think it's interesting.
Now, we should probably qualify the fact that we are recording this week's podcast. Mm. On Wednesday.
Yes, we are.
Like a good few days before this goes out, partly to accommodate Kay's massive jolly. Mm. Now, as a result of that, there is not a lot of news.
No.
Because not a lot has happened, because we literally did the last podcast like 5 minutes ago. So that's, broadly speaking, I would say, all there is, unless there's something you wish to pull out of your back pocket.
Well, there was this news that there's going to be Netflix had unveiled its Japanese content slate for 2025. And there's a show coming up called Last Samurai Standing, which apparently is a Shogun meets Squid Game type affair, which is a period drama, features 300 samurai warriors gathered at a temple in Kyoto, lured by the promise of a 100 billion yen prize.
I mean, that'll do it.
We love Shogun. And you love Squid Game, so it might be a good thing.
I love that you singled me out. We love Shogun, and you love Squid Game.
No, both of you, sorry.
Thank you very
you
much.
Plural.
Yeah. Well, my chopped liver.
The foreign language correspondent falls down on that particular one.
Too violent, you know.
It is very violent. It is very violent. Fine, well, that is all that we have for news for today, so let's move on to this week's second guest. We were talking about Zero Day a minute ago and whether or not things are true. One thing that is true is that Jesse Plemons is on this week's show. Obviously, the start of Breaking Bad and Fargo and Friday Night Lights, and he's back on our screens with Zero Day, which is on Netflix, and he plays opposite Robert De Niro as an aide to De Niro's former president, and someone caught at the heart of a cyber attack that brings America to its knees. I caught up with Plemons in a London hotel last week, and this is what occurred.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I was going to say, like, the thing about acting that always fascinates me is, so you sign up to do this job, you know, to play roles and to tell stories and stuff. And then when you become quite good at it, they say, all right, okay, there's a second part of the job you got to do. We're going to stick you in a hotel room for like 3 days and you talk to 100,000 people who are all going to ask you the same questions. And you're just like, I'm sorry, what now? Completely different skill set, completely different thing. Like, how do you find this madness?
That's so funny. I just said that exact thing probably 30 minutes ago talking to Alexis that was helping me with hair and makeup. It is a completely different skill set. But, you know, I've been doing this for long enough that I've gotten used to it. And aside from, you know, how difficult at times it is to talk about the work when so much of it is kind of hard to articulate at times, it's also just really nice to get together with the group that you worked so hard with and, you know, see them, get to spend time with them in a different setting where you're not all hyper-focused on one thing. But yeah, I mean, and sometimes with getting the same questions over and over again, you do find a way to sort of, for it to make sense in your own head. So you're kind of learning some at the same time.
Yeah, it all kind of falls into place.
What happened, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
But this show in particular is an interesting one because it was obviously written, pre-produced, literally shot before the election before anything happened. And yet it feels like the kind of thing that someone could have written yesterday as a very pointed commentary on, let's say, the current political climate. I mean, were you, you know, when you went and got involved in this, which must have been what, like how long? A year ago? 18 months? How did
before
you start?
Before the writer's strike, we were
okay, so a long time.
Geared up to go. And then, yeah, day one, I was just about to get into the shower to go for my first day and was told to stand down, that we were on pause. And it was a long pause.
And you were like, this again?
Yeah.
It's like they're going to have you murder someone in the first scene with a pipe and that'll be it.
Yeah, I know. But I think what's really interesting about it is that, you know, it has more to do with an examination of truth in a world that is sort of losing a consensus on what that is, which is something that I feel like is relevant all over the world right now. And so, yeah, it is interesting how it does, as time goes on, it does feel more and more.
Do you think that's a very, you know, contemporary thing? Because obviously it's been the age-old axiom, the politician's lie, and like people just accept that. But it does feel like over the past certain number of years that truth has been kind of weaponized, hasn't it? That everything, like alternative facts have become a thing, fake news has become a thing, everyone questions everything and no one accepts anything. And it feels maybe now that it's perhaps more pointed, more dangerous than it's really ever been, right? And that's kind of what this show is. It's like that idea's natural conclusion.
Two separate things, you know. I mean, this is a work of fiction, and the show makes a point not to pick a side or give too much information or overly politicize it in terms of, you know, right, left. But we're also, there's this sort of atmosphere that feels like it's been bubbling and reaching some sort of boiling point where, people are just having a more difficult time talking to each other when they have differing opinions, which is scary, you know.
So my favorite TV show is The West Wing, which feels like it came from a much happier time, right? Because it's like, it's all about bipartisanism and cooperation, and these things, I guess, feel like fantasy now. And I think this show, first of all, exactly as you say, I like the fact that I don't even know if the words Democrat or Republican are mentioned in the show.
No, I don't think so.
Right? So it's very clear they have, you know, partisan politics, but they don't take sides, and they're not, you know, drawing lines where the good guys, those are the bad guys. But it does feel that in the same way that Mullen is a guy who was president, was it 12 years previously he's been in office? So he's been president during a time where people were living a kind of a West Wingian age. And now in this hyper-partisan world, I like that they depict him as a character who, you know, he's in a world that he doesn't understand. Like, that's not the world that he was president in, and that it has changed. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really smart way of putting it together.
It felt a little like a throwback to me, films, you know, political thrillers from the 70s, 80s. I just felt like I hadn't seen anything quite like this in a while.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, very much. So it does have that throwback. I love that about it. Yeah. Like that sense, that real sort of paranoid conspiracy thriller thing, which is kind of cool. I mean, you're a guy who, you get quite into your characters, right? You immerse yourself in them. Like, what did you make of Roger, or Dodgy Rog, as I've come to know him?
Pretty good.
I had a music playlist that was titled Roger Dodger.
Really? Do you do that with your roles? You create like a musical soundtrack for the characters?
I do. Just, I guess my approach is always to find any way in so it doesn't feel like work. So you're just stirring your imagination and you know, allowing your mind and your creativity to just sort of go wherever it wants to, and so that helps just kind of set a mood and get everything flowing.
But I like that idea that you want to kind of sink into that character and you want to kind of get in that headspace, because obviously it makes sense, because the next film that you're doing with Yorgos, you're a conspiracy theorist, right? So it feels like there's an amount of crossover here, because there's a lot of conspiracy theory in this show. Like, did you go down a rabbit hole for one or both of these roles to kind of get in that headspace?
Yeah, well, I mean, very different characters, but I guess similar subject matter. I definitely did, but two very different rabbit holes.
Yeah.
For this one, you know, we had an incredible resource in Noah, the co-writer, who comes from that world, knows everyone in the political world. So a lot of conversations with him. He connected me with a few different people that had similar jobs. I watched a lot of documentaries. You know, The War Room was one that I kept going back to, and I just loved that dynamic of of Carville and Stephanopoulos. Read Stephanopoulos's book about his time with Clinton, and you know, there was something early on that, like, the first sort of spark was these guys, these aides, consultants. There's something of almost like talent agents about them that I felt like I'd never really gotten to play, which was really exciting to me.
They almost insulate people from the outside world, don't they? They're the gateway that everyone goes through them for access. I don't know if you've ever seen, I'm sure you have, like, they often slip them pieces of paper, but like, this is who this person is, and gives them a little bit of information. Yeah. There's an awful lot of that goes on, that the candidates really rely on these people for everything.
And, you know, how much of it is inflated in their heads, you know, or how much of it is sort of created to ensure that whoever they're taking care of really feels like they need them and can't function without them, you know?
You know, he's the gatekeeper to one of the most important people, and that obviously rubs off on him and inflates his sense of ego, which informs a lot of those character decisions that we won't spoil here. But it's a very interesting job. You've read lots of books and stuff. Did you ever get to sort of shadow anyone or speak to anyone who's done that work?
I did. I met with a few former aides and consultants of Clinton. And really everyone that Noah connected me with, extremely candid and you know, happy to talk and give me their experience of what it was like. So it was really, that's the fun part, you know, just fishing around and like I said, finding what is the most exciting way into something.
And you've worked obviously with Leslie before. Mm-hmm. Does that make things easier for, I mean, she worked on The West Wing as well. So did Eli Atty, who wrote, I think, episode 4. But is it always nice when you have a familiar face behind the camera?
Most definitely. And you enter into it knowing that there's a familiarity and a trust. And, you know, I mean, with that first miniseries I did with Leslie, you know, it was about an affair.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time, you know, with her in hotel rooms and my underwear.
So it's like, you're not embarrassed about anything now.
Yeah. So we were good to go.
No, that was a really fun show. I've very much enjoyed, in particular, the scene where the two of you sit down and lay out the rules for how the affair's going to work, which is just deadpan genius, the whole thing. And speaking of deadpan, obviously Connie is in the show, so it's Mrs. Coach. So that's kind of exciting. And the thing that I always loved about Landry in Friday Night Lights was he's like the comedic heart of that show, and the deadpan humor there is absolute gold. And I was like, is that, how much of that is you? How much of your humor is very like that?
Oh, well, thanks. I don't know. It's hard to find, I guess, the percentage of what's you and what's the character. But it was that part, I initially read for Matt Saracen and did the scene. I was like, okay, that was fine. And then she handed me the sides. Linda Lowy, the casting director, handed me the sides for Landry, and I took maybe 10 minutes and... It was one of the rare instances where there was just something instant and innate where I just felt like I knew him. Sort of an amalgam of kids I grew up with, and I just loved this, you know, this guy that is truly very intelligent and also extremely confident in his ideas and his opinions and his view of the world, and just gives, you know, his social intelligence is probably lacking a little bit, but to be able to play everything that comes out of his mouth as 100% earnest and sincere, yeah. and he means everything he says, and it's fact. And so that's, yeah, that's a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, it's a hell of a show, but it's funny, like, looking back and thinking, as you say, the ratings weren't always great, but it is generally on every critic's best TV shows of all time list now.
Yeah.
But then no one watched The Wire either, and right. no one watched Breaking Bad initially either. Right. And these are all shows which are now, like, on the Mount Rushmore of great TV shows. It's just, it's wild how, you know, history treats things differently, right, than they are in the moment.
It is, yeah. I feel very, very fortunate to snuck my way in there.
But, like, you know, you played a vast number of different characters, from comedic characters to complete sociopaths, right? And you know, this character, I think, is slightly more towards the former, with a little bit of the latter in there. But like, how much crossover is there? Like, how much of that do you end up sort of, like, taking home? Because, as you say, like, if you immerse yourselves in these characters, a lot of it has to kind of, there has to be a bit of a two-way street there, right?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think of it as, you know, you're in character and you can't shake the character, you go home. You know, I would imagine any profession that you're spending a large part of the day thinking about,
yeah.
your brain does just naturally kind of fall into a rhythm of hyper-focused.
I know a number of characters, or a lot of actors, I should say, immerse themselves in the character, whether it be method or however they do it, and try and find the truth in the character, whereas you get much more technical actors who are very much more about process and this almost the science of acting. You know, if you work with so many amazing actors, you've worked with Robert De Niro now 3 times, right? You know, you can learn a lot from that guy, I've heard. And, you know, if you work with Scorsese, you've worked with Spielberg, you've worked with Vince Gilligan, you know, all these different people. Like, do you find yourself leaning towards that kind of technical thing, like what you can learn from people, or is it more organic for you? Is it all about the character?
Well, I think probably going back to Friday Night Lights, I think what the way I approach it is that there, you know, nothing is really off limits. If something inspires you, it doesn't matter what it is. And, you know, people are different. And so what it takes for one person to feel ready and like they have a handle on the character isn't going to be the same for another person. And then at the same time, I myself, like everyone else, is constantly changing. And so what, you know, the way in or the approach that once worked can all of a sudden sort of dry up and you have to reevaluate and find some other way. And so it's like, that's what's fun, is that there are no rules.
Do you think that because you were a child actor, that changed the way you see acting? Obviously, Kirsten, also a child actor. You know, you talk about this. Is that something that, do you think if you'd come to this as an adult, you might look at it in a different way?
I don't know. That's hard to say because, you know, it is one of the few jobs where it's like, it's in the job to describe, you know, it's called this film, television, obviously, but you know, a play. That's yeah. the nature of it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's been so incredible about getting to work with all the ridiculously talented people that I've been able to work with is, you know, not to say that there aren't days that require a lot of focus and it feels more like work, but in my experience, the majority of the actors whose work I really respond to, who I feel like I've learned from, there is that sense of play and exploration and enjoying the fact that we get to do this for a living. It's crazy, you know?
It is very much so.
Yeah.
But, you know, great work if you can get it. I mean, yeah. Last question I would throw to you is, obviously, you've worked with genuinely some of the best directors in cinema and some of the best showrunners in TV. And I just wondered what your relationship is between cinema and television. Do you like the kind of, you know, intensity and focus of film work? Do you prefer the long-form storytelling of TV and the fact that you build relationships and maintain them with the character and the people you work with over a longer period of time? Like, or do they just scratch different itches for you?
I think they do scratch different itches. I mean, it's hard to say. I think so much of it kind of depends on where you're at personally, kind of what how much you're willing to bite off and you know, time commitments and all that with the family are definitely factors. But I enjoy all of it. You know, I enjoy the films that are, you know, isolated, and you know it's going to be a lot of work for 2 or 3 months, and then that's it. And then, you know, at the same time, being on a television show where you don't know what's coming, and you get to spend so much time with a character, that's a lot of fun in its own way. And then there's the limited series that's kind of in between, yeah. You know, which is great. Depends on the time and the part in the project, but I enjoy all of it for different reasons.
Well, have a good time in Budapest. There is a statue of Peter Falk there. In the center of Budapest, there is a statue of Peter Falk with the dog scratching his head with a cigar in character as Columbo.
If you ever talk to Mark Ruffalo, I've only met him a few times, but he's very nice. He does the best Peter Falk impression I've ever heard.
Yeah, so I've heard, and everyone is lobbying for him to play Columbo, like to come back and do it.
I didn't know that.
But yeah, it's something to do with the mayor of Budapest. I can't remember the story behind it, but I remember this is like the landmark in Budapest. So.
Oh, wow.
Something to do on a downtime. Amazing. Well, Jesse, thanks very much.
That was Jesse Plemons, and time now for this week's reviews. And we begin this week, where else would we begin than with The White Lotus on Sky and Now. This is Mike White's satirical comedy, which sees awful people in lovely places, which is nice. This time around, we're off to Thailand, and checking in at the desk are Amy Lee Wood, Jason Isaacs, Walton Goggins, Parker Posey, Michelle Monaghan, Leslie Bibb, and Carrie Coon, to name but a few. Kay, please tell us, what is your position, and have you gone full Lotus?
I've gone full Lotus. I want to be in Thailand right now. That's one of the big takeaways from this.
Is that next week's jolly? Or
yes, I'm right. Going to go after the event to visit the site of this film.
That seems fair.
And yeah, it's just a joy. I loved the previous two seasons. This series is no different. As you said, it's got an incredible cast. Amy Lou Wood having such a moment, from Sex Education to Big Mood, Daddy Issues, Toxic Town, which I've watched and can't talk about, and now this. She is just incredible and has been richly rewarded for her talent in this. She plays the girlfriend of Rick, played by the actor's name's gone out of my head.
Walton Goggins.
Yes, thank you. Who is a real sort of like piece of work character. He is incredibly rich. They're kind of island hopping. They've got a lot of money, so they can just do what they want. And she is constantly talking him off the ledge because he's very highly strung, and he's clearly there with an agenda to talk to the owner of this very posh resort. And he treats her really badly. Like, it's quite uncomfortable. Like, she tries to jolly him along and he's not that nice to her. But she handles it very well and is kind of like, shall we have one more? Shall we just get off our tits this final night before we detox? Once again, it's like the whole commentary of, you know, what it is to go to one of these resorts, the kind of clientele it attracts, mostly white, particularly white bald men. I'm looking at you guys.
It is true. There is a line about there's an abundance of white bald men at these resorts.
They call them LBHs, losers back home.
Thanks.
Yeah, felt seen. We both felt seen.
Yeah. Seen and attacked simultaneously.
Yeah. But yeah, it's these incredibly rich white clients who, you know, it's highlighted by Natasha Rothwell's character, Belinda, who is visiting from Hawaii to be trained up. And she's very excited about that because she wouldn't usually get to stay in a place like this. And she kind of looks around and makes friends with the waves to the only two black people.
Yes. And she's from the previous season, isn't she? Yeah.
Season one.
Oh, from, actually. Okay, yeah. Right. Yeah,
she's hung all over from season one.
And so, as always, it's about who this place, you know, who's attracted to this place. So we've got this family. So in this family, it's led by Jason Isaacs as Timothy Ratliff and Parker Posey as the mum, Victoria, plus the children, Patrick Schwarzenegger, Sam Nivola as Lachlan, and Sarah Catherine Hook as Piper. And what I find so interesting about this family is just the weird dynamic, right, between the children, particularly like Patrick. This character, as you say, is a kind of doofus, playboy guy who fancies himself. He works for the family company. He thinks he's a hot shot both in business and with the ladies. And actually, he's got really shit game. Like, he tries to flirt with these women around the pool and it's just excruciating. But the dynamic with the children is that the two youngest, I don't know, they seem quite close. Seemingly close.
A bit Game of Thrones close, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit weird. There's a suggestion. That's obviously what they're trying to do. They're suggesting that something untoward's going on. But also between the brothers. So, like, at first, Piper, Lockie says he will share rooms because there's only three rooms. He will share a room with Piper, and then the brother, Patrick, like kind of points out that's really weird. And so he then bunks up with Patrick's character of Saxton. But then there's a moment, which I won't ruin, where like there's a bit of a voyeuristic
moment. The cock and ball sequence, I think we can say,
the aforementioned Arnold Schwarzenegger approved nude shot of Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, his apples don't fall far from his tree.
Exactly.
Indeed. I was just kind of...
Oh, it's deliberately ambiguous and provocative.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's like a tug of war between the older brother and the sister for the youngest soul, almost, and you know, friendship. And that battle continues, just to say.
Also, there's a group of friends. So we've got Carrie Coon as Laurie, Leslie Bibb as Kate, and Michelle Monaghan, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
As Jacqueline, Jackie, who's famous. And that's an interesting dynamic as well, because anyone who's kept in touch with their school friends will know that you have this bond from childhood or whichever stage in life you met. But then obviously you go, you know, your paths diverge. And it's about them trying to reunite on this trip, which Jackie is paid for. So there's this power dynamic there. But also two of them, Kate and Jackie, get on much better or seemingly have like a closer relationship than Carrie Coon's character, and it's interesting to see how she reacts to that. Spoiler, she hits the bottle, but that's also an interesting dynamic that I'm quite invested in. So but I've obviously crucially missed out the fact that it starts off with a gunman going crazy in this resort, shooting at seemingly random people.
Now this is the format for the White Lotus, isn't it, that you'll get a cold open and then everything builds up to where
it
that
flashes
goes
back. There's essentially like a killing or a violent incident at the beginning, and so there's always that who done it or what, who was done in. It's there's a mystery surrounding a violent
who is
act.
The body and who is the
exactly,
killer.
Exactly, which it sticks with. And I think it's the most intense one so far. After I thought it was really
it's clever. A hell of a compelling
it's a great
cold
scene.
Open.
It's a great
it really
scene.
Is.
And that character that we see there is Natasha Rothwell's son. He's the son of the one who was in season one. Carry on.
I think it's incredibly compelling and engaging, as it has always been. Lavish, you see the money on screen and makes you want to be there. It's escapism, like it's very addictive.
How many episodes have you watched?
I've only watched one episode, but we've got the episodes available to us, but I think
we've got six out of eight.
I might watch it on the week. I might just do it
on the bounce with the normies.
Yes, I want a delayed gratification, perhaps.
Well, I've seen two, so I've seen twice as much of the show as you have.
Which, coming from someone who traditionally doesn't watch The White Lotus.
That's right.
It's quite a...
feeling... I was about to say uncharacteristically smug, but that would be would be a stretch.
Yeah. No, I'm
the right normal amount of smugness.
It feels a bit Patrick Schwarzenegger what you just did there, like a swinging competition, and you think you won.
Oh, his whole he's got an inner Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Wow.
No, honestly, he's the least Patrick Schwarzenegger of any grown man I've ever met.
Oh my god, which is brilliant. It's an even bigger cuss, frankly.
No, because as you say, Schwarzenegger's character is an absolute douche. Like, he's literally referred to throughout as being.
Yes.
Whereas James is a lovely, well-adjusted.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm serious. Anyway.
Four to five stars.
So you watched two?
Yes, I watched two. I watched one, and then because we didn't do a third show this week because we didn't get win or losing time, I watched the second one by way of compensation.
So what did you think? Because
Because obviously I've watched all six.
Of course you have.
And failed to note what happens in each one. Although there is an official... Did you get the official spoiler list?
I didn't read it.
There is an official spoiler from HBO, which is very handy. And my question is, though, is if it's not mentioned in the official spoilers, does that mean I'm free, I have carte blanche to say what I want to say?
As long as it's not going to ruin it for listeners.
Yeah. So my question about, is it episode two where there's the Jason Isaacs moment?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Do you know what I mean when
I interviewed him?
I don't know which moment you're referring to. There is a plot development involving Jason Isaacs' character.
There's a shot. There's a shot.
Is it another cock and balls?
Yeah, so now it's not on the embargo list, and it's not a plot point, it's just a shot.
Right.
But, so this is the thing I alluded to last week, which is that I interviewed Jason about this show, and I'd only had two episodes at that point. And then they sent me the rest four more, and that's when the realisation happens, where there's a sudden Jason Isaacs cock and bull shot. And I didn't know at that point. But bizarrely, in the interview, I said to him, you're working with this maverick figure, Mike White, the writer, producer, director, etc., who loves to have a shock moment like the sudden close-up of the cock and balls in season one. And Jason
and two.
Jason Knight says, well, you haven't seen anything yet. And
he knew that his chat would be on display.
Yeah, exactly. The little Jason was in the...
Or not so little Jason was in the show.
But it is an extraordinary moment, particularly if you know Jason Isaacs. And just...
Wow, that is a hello to Jason Isaacs, isn't it?
The ultimate hello to Jason Isaacs.
What an intro.
Honestly. And now I feel like I want to go back and get another 5 minutes with him to get the full...
Oh, my God, I thought you were going to say, now I want to go back and rewatch.
That's right, I know what you were going to say.
Oh, I've done that multiple times already. No, I want to ask him all about it because it's such an extraordinary moment. And it's... anyway, it's just a full-on shot of him. You know, it's not like a close-up where you see his face is there. And it's fantastic. And
it's obviously
like,
something about that Ratliff family.
Yeah.
They just like to get it out.
Well, as to your point, though, you talked about I'm sorry, but I've seen reviews of this with something. I think the pace is probably slightly slower than the previous two seasons, right? Because this is the longest season yet. It's 8 episodes. I think season one was 6, season two, 7. It's like going up and up. This is season 8. There are more characters to take into account in this one as well. But for me, it's even though not a lot, apart from that incredible opening, which is a brilliant, the cold open with the attack, whatever's happening with the gunshots, you don't really know what's going on, and it does settle down. It draws you into the characters, the different groups of characters, the family, the three women, Natasha Rothwell's character, and the couple, etc. Walton Goggins, and all that. Emily Wood. I just found it unbelievably immersive, and there's something about the way that he does have of the shots of the monkeys and the trees and the wildlife and the sea and the water, all this imagery that he kind of drops in all the way through. And then he loves a breakfast, right? But they're all having their breakfasts. And he just kind of drops into their conversations. And I mentioned this last week, how influenced he is by reality TV. I think his dialogue is so brilliantly clever. It's not right remarkable. It just draws you
naturalistic.
It's naturalistic, and it draws you into their stories and their interrelations. Like the three women, the three friends, fascinating. Like, you don't know... And all of the characters, I think, start out where you think you know who they are and what they're up to, and then he completely pulls the rug. Almost every single character as it goes along. So, for example, what's interesting is Jason Isaac's wife, played by Parker Posey, and if I have one criticism, it is this. She is a lot.
Yes, she is.
Tall, isn't it? I found that a little bit annoying.
Is it North Carolina, South Carolina? I can't remember which one. It's a Carolina.
It's a bit, they both have to do a big Southern accent.
Yeah.
And I think he does pretty well. That one review said sometimes he just doesn't bother at all. Which I think it's when you're doing he has a lot to do, and I think he's brilliant. This is one of Jason Isaac's best roles. He's so good in it. So he's got the accent to deal with. He's got a lot. He's got that shot to deal with, I mentioned, and a huge amount out more that he has to deal with as it goes on. And she's obviously a prescription drug addicted. That's one of the things that we know about her pretty early on. And she's meant to be a big character. You know, what we've had big characters in the show before, but she slightly rubs up against the rest of her family and Jason a little bit. But I have to say that's a minor criticism, because as it goes along, you get used to it and you almost get more reasons for her to be who she is in the show.
I think it's an affectation. I think it's like because she's like, you know, on all those drugs and so like she's so heightened, but she probably doesn't realize it.
Completely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's fitting with the character.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like Jennifer Coolidge's character was a lot, but there are people like that. And I think that would be Mike White's justification for this in a way, and hers as well as the performer, is that you do meet people who are over the top and ludicrous. As it goes on, you find out more about her. But every grouping, every couple, the Walton Goggins, Amy Lee Wood, oh my God, it's so good. He's just so fucking pissed off all the time. And so it means that when he's not pissed off, that various moments might happen, or you find out more about why he's so pissed off. It's fascinating. But I do think the family, Jason Isaacs, Parker Posey, and their three kids.
The youngest kid was
Nicole Kidman's son in The Perfect Couple. That's where you recognize him from. The whole ambiguity about the three kids Who they are, what they're up to, the sexuality, the taboo that it's kind of addressing there, the possibility. He's so clever at like just planting little ideas in your head, which, as I say, almost with all the characters, particularly that family, I think it's absolutely extraordinary and fascinating what they're up to and what's going on with them, the interrelations. As I said, it is a bit of a slow burn, perhaps slightly slower than usual, but it's so intensely gripping from the off. It's so beautifully made. It looks incredible. The cinematography, you know, the production design, everything, all the different characters. We haven't mentioned the Thai characters. It's a really interesting Thai characters who work at the hotel. I think it's fucking brilliant. It's so good. James.
You mentioned the Thai characters. Can I, as is my wont, mention the subtitles? I really, really loved the subtitles. I've never seen anything like it. When they're speaking in Thai, they have obviously in white block the English translation, but behind it, and it's almost like a watermark, they have it written in Thai as well.
It's great,
and it just looks really arresting. And I think it gives it a real stylized look.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, whether it's on Disney Plus, they'd find a way to fuck it up, but luckily it isn't. So we get to see it properly.
Unprovoked attack.
Yeah.
But I had good subtitle energy.
It did. Mm. Is that your main observation?
That's my main observation. No, to your point on that, I think he has, exactly as you say, an incredible lightness of touch when it comes to character study. In that, you're right, he doesn't ram anything down your throat, as even the best TV shows have a tendency to trade in archetype a lot of the time, partly because of runtime. They don't, you know, you can't invest hundreds of hours in sort of like developing a character, you know, and sometimes it's a very plotty show. They need to drive the plot forward and you can't spend too much time sort of delving into too much of inner character workings. I think what he does very well is every character you meet here feels like a living, breathing person. They feel like they have an inner life. You feel like you've met these people. They feel believable. They feel authentic. For good and bad, and let's be honest, mostly for bad. But exactly what you say, like Harry Coon, Michelle Monaghan, Leslie Bibb, that character dynamic is brilliant because you've got the really successful one, the others who are trying to seem more successful than they are. She quite likes having a little entourage. I think she's a little bit aware, as you say, the power imbalance, that they're sort of on her coattails a little bit. But then if she leaves the room, they won't miss an opportunity to slag her off. And two of them is always slagging off the third one when they're not in the room.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating and it's kind of believable. It's really bitchy and it's really real.
Do you know what? Just on a little note on that, my mum always says three in a friendship group never works.
Yeah.
And it's so true.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
And they're quite childish in brilliantly, aren't they? Like, as soon as they notice the two have gone off to chat, they're all like jealous and
spite.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. It's like us as a three.
That's exactly it. Yes, exactly it.
I think we never go on holiday with you.
When we eventually go to Fiji, this will happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it all plays out brilliantly. And I like the interplay between the staff there as well. The only thing about this show, and I was watching it and I was thinking, right, James, get into this. Why don't you like The White Lotus? Watching it, I'm like, it looks beautiful. It's brilliantly written. It's incredibly well observed. It is slow, but I don't always hate that because it does focus on character. And it is a slow burn. Like Beth described it as glacial, but I don't think she meant that as a criticism. I think she really likes that.
Mm.
And I know this has had mixed reviews, but when I say mixed, I don't know that it's had much that's super negative. I think middling kind of, it's a victim of its own success. It's too long. It's too slow. The cast of characters is too swollen. Those were kind of the criticisms. But Beth, in her review, she reviewed it for Empire, she described it as a jamboree of misery. And again, she didn't mean that as a criticism. She's a Mike White's jamboree of misery, and she loves it. She gave this 4 stars. She delights in this show. I think that's where I struggle with it. It is kind of a jamboree of misery in that what he does with this show so well, he weaponizes discomfort.
Mm.
He makes you feel acutely uncomfortable all the way through it. And sometimes it's because there's cringe in it. Not so much cringe comedy, just incredibly awkward situations. There is a scene in one of the episodes here where a character goes up to another character who she has met in the past and says, oh, we know each other because... And it is one of the most excruciating things you've ever seen. It's actively painful. So you've got moments like that. And then you've just got being around these awful characters who have no social mores. Walton Goggins' character, who is so apocalyptically rude.
Mm.
And that makes you feel really uncomfortable. And whether it's the siblings and their relationship, I don't think there's ever a point in this where you'll just feel quite chilled. Like, given that it's about meditation, that's quite ironic.
Do you know what's funny, though? It's that I think I can handle that level of... Because I agree with you, but I think I can handle it because of the setting, right? Which I think is a commentary
it's a relaxing
in itself.
Setting.
You can act like an arsehole if you're in a beautiful place. No, but I think it's true. I think it's something, there's something about it, which is like any behaviour sort of goes in this very luxurious place.
But and you're saying if it took place on like a Sheffield council estate, it would be a very different vibe.
Genuinely. Yeah. Like I think there's something in it. As for the slow pace, I feel like the second series was the same for me, like set in Italy. But actually, I think it's really fitting with the place Thailand and the way of life. I think you just lapse into it.
Well, what he does, I think what he's, and it's all very deliberate, the pacing. And that's why I think, and I think most of the reviews that I've read have pretty much said, yes, it is slow, but it's brilliant. And we love it anyway. I think that seems to be quite rightly the general gist, which as a completely Beth hit the nail on the head totally. But what it's particularly deliberate is because he structures it. And I think this goes for all three series in my mind, but mostly even more so this time around, is he structures it so that you're getting to know all the characters more and more and more. He drops more hints and ideas, and then he pulls the rug from under you. Almost every single character starts out doing something and being a certain way and ends up doing something completely the opposite. And it's incredible. You don't see them coming, these little kind of mini twists and turns. And then by about episode 4/5, almost halfway through, suddenly it becomes really pacey and intense. And much literally the editing is much faster and things become hectic and like a whirlwind, and you're like even more on edge then. Because if you think you're on edge to start with, wait till you get to the episodes where they're in a nightclub, and because they go out of the hotel in this series, and you see other locations within Thailand, and it just gets a lot more. There's drugs, there's drink, there's people going hysterical, this hedonism, exactly. And so it's deliberately, I think he totally deliberately lulls you into the peace and calm and tranquility almost, albeit with all these awkward social moments that James talks about. But then halfway through, just over, it just becomes helter-skelter. And it works brilliantly.
Because
you know all those people now and you totally believe them. And now you're watching them to see which of them ends up in a fucking disastrous nightmare that's impending on all of them, perhaps, or perhaps some of them.
I think I'm doing a live reverse ferret whereby I might binge them all.
I think it's another contender, you see, of where we do a spoiler special each week, because it's so interesting to talk about.
I suggested
there's so much
it, but James
about.
Is know, not keen just, to watch, I don't yeah. think. Are you, or have you been convinced?
To be honest, again, it's like watching it. I could force myself. I think it's not naturally, because I find it quite stressful to watch.
Yeah.
That's, I think, why I don't gravitate towards it. And again, if we're talking about the Bell End test, most of the characters are, to a greater or lesser extent, awful.
Yeah.
And it's all by design. I think that's where I personally struggle with this kind of show, because it's the discomfort and the stress and the awful characters. It doesn't sort of buoy me along.
You know, if there's one character that isn't a Bell End and is an absolute joy.
Mook.
The security guard.
No, Mook and the Shooter Guard, but even more of is Amy Lou Wood.
Oh, she's delightful.
She's fucking delightful.
And I have to say, if there's an MVP in this, of the episodes I've watched, she is 100% it. Because that character, and again, this goes to Mike White's writing again, she could have very easily been a kind of wishy-washy character as a foil to Walton Goggins' character, who's very, you know, gruff and moody, and she's his much younger girlfriend. But she takes the piss out of him, and she takes from him, and she's really fun, and she's really funny.
She cuts through his BS.
Yeah, and she's very open to the world, and she's just very positive and wholesome, and she's a great character. It's, she plays
it
brilliantly.
Absolutely brilliant, yeah. And she's got a lightness of touch that is spectacular.
But
even when it gets really a lot.
Yeah, as Kay said, she's having a good old time at the moment. She's fantastic. But yeah, The White Lotus season 3, which lands on HBO, not HBO, it lands on HBO in the States, but it lands on Sky and Now over here.
On Monday today.
This
is the day the podcast comes out, 17th February, 9 o'clock. I think they're showing at 2 a.m. the night before, like as it goes out on HBO as well. That's Sky tends to do with its super big.
2024 or?
2025,
okay. Cool.
Yeah, the year 2025, yeah. One a week, as we say.
Have either of you been to Thailand?
Yes.
Did you stay in a place like the White Lotus?
I have. Not as bougie. But yeah, I've been in a resort, a wellness resort. It's very nice.
I have too. I stayed at one in Koh Samui, which is very nice.
I like the last two episodes. We've been exposing James's travels from India to
my travelogues. Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah. All right, well then, The White Lotus. Let's move on to the next show this week, and it is 1,000 Blows, this one on Disney+. Stephen Knight, whose prolific output continues to both captivate and terrify, quite frankly, has penned yet another prestige drama, and this is about the 40 Elephants, which is an all-female street gang in Victorian London, and also the seedy world of bare-knuckle boxing. This one stars Malachi Kirby. Is it Malachi or Malachi?
Kai.
Kai. This one stars Malachi Kirby, Stephen Graham, and Erin Doherty, and doesn't play by Queensbury rules. Does it, Boydie? Did this show punch you in the face?
Symbolically, maybe. It's interesting, yeah, because another show that we couldn't review, by the way, that is out in our week, starting on Saturday, the 22nd of February, is a show called Dope Girls, which is a BBC show, which is set in Soho and is kind of all about the rise of drugs, drink, and illicit activity after the First World War. And it's a huge period piece about these female criminals and gangs, and the crossover, both in tone and subject matter, with A Thousand Blows is really intriguing and fascinating, because A Thousand Blows, as you said, kind of talks about, shows you these women, led by Erin Doherty's Mary. And Erin Doherty's fantastic, by the way. So you completely believe that she is this kind of powerful figure who doesn't take any shit from the men she's surrounded by, some of whom are absolute bellends and even more objectionable than the people in The White Lotus. So it kind of mixes this idea, which apparently these are all based by Stephen Knight. Kay will know more about this than me, because she's done research for her Q&A that she's hosting, I'm sure. But I think they're all based on actual character people,
yes,
roughly,
so
aren't they?
So Mary, Hezekiah, and Sugar Goodson, and his brother Treacle. They're all real historical people, historical characters based on real people, but they were around at the same time in the same locale.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't know if they ever really met, but that's where...
Yeah, it's not a documentary, is it?
No.
Yeah, it's
confirmed by James, this is a drama, not a documentary.
It's a drama, not a documentary.
Oh, sure. I've watched the wrong show.
But this is, what I thought about is, this is a Stephen Knight show writ large. Stephen Knight, who Jack Thorne and Stephen basically write everything, and maybe James Graham now as well. There are like three or four incredibly
and they write everything on TV.
Write everything on TV, more or less. But I think this is the most Peaky Blinders-esque Stephen Knight project since Peaky Blinders, since he launched Peaky Blinders, because it is about, you know, it's a period piece about crime and other and groupings, and she's leading a girl gang as opposed to the male gangs of Peaky Blinders itself. But just the whole kind of tone of it, the visuals in a way, the way he pulls the rug from under you, the very first scene, he has a clever kind of bait and switch thing as in depicting the crime that happens. Kay's looking at me as if I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, I'd forgotten it, sorry.
Yeah. Well, you obviously watched the whole thing. And I think that's because Stephen Knight's done a lot of stuff recently where it doesn't feel like necessarily essential Stephen Knight, even like SAS Rogue Heroes. I really like SAS Rogue Heroes, but I can also take my time to finish watching it. You know, I haven't finished the second series yet, and it went out, you know, a month ago.
I really love SAS Rogue Heroes.
Oh, no, it's great. Yeah. It's great, yeah. You hosted the Q&A for that as well.
Yes.
Anyway, but this feels more thrilling to me, that if you like, because right from the start, there's high stakes, there's people, there's violence, there's the boxing itself is done really well. The whole Stephen Graham, you referenced this in your intro. Mm. I mean, they make almost like a turn him into almost like this icon of a boxing guy, and you kind of say they kind of deliberately, the way it's filmed and shot, like this huge big muscle guy. You see his back, his muscly back, and it's Stephen Graham, and it just is like quite a shock that he is the one who's this kind of like immensely powerful.
He's
boxer.
Terrifying in this.
Yeah, he's so good. He's so brilliant. But they all are. Malachi Kirby makes Hezekiah into such an he wants to become a lion tamer, and there's a heartbreaking little mini story within that whereby he finds out the situation regarding the zoo or the places where he wants to be the lion tamer at, which was really clever. Stephen Knight at his best, and I think this is him at his best, can draw you into a character and into a storyline and into a world and build the world so quickly, so that by the end of episode one, you're fully immersed in this extraordinary depiction of the East End in this time. You've got to know three or four characters really well, and you totally believe them already. And there's a kind of inner tension, because there's people with guns, and there's people who shouldn't have guns, and there's people conducting criminality, in desperation, and you care about what's going on. I thought it was great, and I'm really excited. And to watch the first two, fully in, and I can't wait to finish it.
Kay, you are in the pocket of Big Knight, but still.
Yes. Knight Rider. this on paper shouldn't be a show I like because it's about boxing, it's quite violent, but actually I really enjoyed it. I love a period drama. As you say, I am hosting the thing, so I am prejudiced, I'm sure, biased rather. But I really liked it because I think first of all, the boxing is so well done. It doesn't feel like you're watching two actors. It feels like you're just watching a boxing match. The transformation of them and the way it's been filmed and choreographed is amazing. Like those two characters, and they're different styles of boxing as well. Like because Stephen Graham's character, Sugar Goodson, it just goes in there like a pit bull or a British bulldog, as he describes himself, goes in there full of muscle, just aims to kill, like by hook or by crook, whichever methods he's going to, you know, land fatal blows on his opponent. Whereas with Hezekiah, it's just more graceful. There's something about it. Do you know what I mean? He's like, floats like a butterfly.
Indeed.
So I like that element, but also I really love Mary Carr as a character, and that kind of like her as a feminist icon amongst the thieves. They are thick as thieves and they're so close, like a family unit, the Forty Elephants, which are real. I didn't know anything about them. And then I fell into a Google hole, like obsessively researching them. But also I really like how these three main characters of Sugar, Mary and Hezekiah, their stories are so intertwined, which we're going to see, and how Mary essentially brings about the downfall of most of the men in this series, which I enjoyed. And also like watching their heists, the 40 Elephants heist, because they are audacious and, yeah, incredibly bold. So, I mean, predictably, I like this.
I have to say, lots of good people in this. Erin Doherty is kind of the standout for me. I think mm-hmm. she's so good in this. She was really good. If you saw Firebrand or Reawakening, both films, sorry, we should be talking about them in this podcast. But she's also been, she was in The Crown, wasn't she?
Yeah,
she was Princess Anne, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's really, really good in this. She has a magnetism. And I think Stephen Knight, what he does really well is create these very larger-than-life characters and larger-than-life situations. He almost cartoonifies something that could be quite gritty and grubby and sort of mean and sort of in the gutter. And he makes it seem, like the whole thing with Peaky Blinders, he made these guys seem like rock stars.
Mm.
And there's an element of that here as well. Like, he's really, really good at this stuff. And I think it just gives you an incredible sense of that period and of sort of like Victorian East End London.
It's, the sets, how authentic. It feels like you're walking around in
Victorian
London.
It's got Disney Plus money
on
it. I mean, the sets, the extras, the number of extras. You can always
So with, many extras. So many extras.
Yeah, yeah.
And also we should say Tom Davis in it.
Yeah, big Tom Davis.
We love. Daniel Mays. Like, yeah, really great supporting cast as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a really good show, and I like the different, because you've got two different worlds, isn't it? Because it's not interesting, because you've got, it's the 40 Thieves, essentially, as they were often called, 40 Elements or the 40 Thieves, they went by both, and you've got the sort of the boxing thing with Sugar Goodson, and those two stories kind of dance in and out of each other throughout the show.
Yeah, and it's also the old world, new world, so like Sugar's very much of the bare knuckle, he owns the last pub
that
does bare knuckle fighting, and his brother wants him to get into gloved boxing.
Which was a new thing at the time.
Like, gentrification, it wasn't of
how people fought, like that wasn't and how boxing works,
yeah,
you know?
So it's like East End versus West End,
right? So there's a little bit of a culture war there, and it's sort of emblematic of these sort of padded gloves that they didn't like. It's fascinating. He's like I say, he's very, very good at this. Obviously this doesn't hold a candle to Stephen Knight's best work, My Beloved Sea, but that aside I had a good time.
Somehow it's even better than Sea.
Oh, don't be ridiculous.
I mean, I know it's
there's no one wank praying at any point in this show. No. I put
it
to you.
I think the only way to resolve it for you two is to get the gloves on.
That's it.
Fight it out.
Get in the ring. 1,000 Blows, then, which lands on Disney Plus when, Boydie?
Friday, the 21st of February, 2025.
Super. And there's a lot of other stuff out this week. So the aforementioned Win or Lose, which lands on Disney Plus on Wednesday the 19th. Season 3 of Reacher, which lands on Prime Video on Thursday the 20th. Also on Thursday the 20th, Zero Day lands on Netflix too. What else have we got? Surface Season 2 lands on Apple on Friday. And on Saturday, we've got Dope Girls, which you mentioned already. On Sunday, Belgravia, the next chapter, comes to ITV. And also Snowpiercer. Now, you remember Snowpiercer, like all of it lands on ITV, which is quite exciting, on ITVX on Sunday. And remember Snowpiercer, like they did the fourth series and it was filmed, but then it was never released and no one thought they would ever get to see it. Well, I believe it has since surfaced anyway. I'm not sure if this is the first time you can see it, but anyway, all of them are on ITVX. If you should wish to watch all of Snowpiercer, you can. Is there anything else? Have I missed anything?
No, I think you've covered it pretty much. I mean, there's a live EastEnders episode because it's the 40th anniversary of EastEnders, but, you know, that's not something you would probably want to know.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there is.
Okay, exciting. Right, well, with that in mind, what is our pick of
this week is so hard.
Oh, it's The White Lotus, come on.
Yeah, I might say The White Lotus, although I do love 1,000 Blows. But yeah, White Lotus.
Yeah, it's a tricky one for me. I enjoyed A Thousand Blows more because it's more my kind of show. Mm-hmm. But The White Lotus is... I can recognize that it is brilliant, even if it is not my thing. So, do you know what? Just for balance, I'll go with A Thousand Blows.
Mm. Good.
Super. Right, that is it. We are done for this week's show. If you enjoyed it, please do head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-blow rating. I don't know, something like that. Just give us a good review. We'd appreciate it. And if you want to follow us on social media, we are at Pilot TV Pod on Blue Sky, on Twitter, on Instagram. And of course, there is a Pilot TV subreddit as well, should you wish to darken our doors there. On Thursday's Pilot Plus, we're going to be covering Day Zero, Zero Day, whichever it's called. Is it day zero? It is zero day.
Yeah.
I'm getting it right. So it is zero day. Yes, yeah. I keep calling it day zero. Unbelievable. I have a whole thing about
this. Feels
right.
Like day zero.
Yeah, it does a little bit. Right. Zero day comes to Netflix. We will be covering that on Pilot Plus. We might also talk about Reacher as well. And Surface Season 2, we may end up doing on Pilot Plus, or more likely we'll get punted to next week's show as well. And what else is out next week? 1923, the Yellowstone spin-off, is back for a second season. That's exciting. Small Town, Big Story that Boyd mentioned, that's coming to Sky. Toxic Town, which Kay mentioned, is coming to Netflix, so that should be a pretty much full card for next week. And also Jason Isaacs will be on this very podcast discussing his cock and balls with Boyd.
Well, no, he doesn't discuss his cock and balls because I hadn't seen the
cock and balls. Ruined the interview. But it's done. That's it.
He discusses cock
why listen to it.
Yeah.
Clickbait.
Unbelievable. You ruined the Jason Isaacs interview by not bringing up his cock and balls. Mm. All right. Fine, enough. Well, you'll get to listen to it next week anyway. In the meantime, I think we should all organise a trip, an ortbo, if you will, to Thailand. With or without Jason Isaacs. Pilot out.